Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today you'll hear about this weekend's performances by Nancy Karp and dancers, which will feature music performed live by Kate Stenberg, Jana Abandola, and our own Sarah Cahill, with original music by Koi Dong, who joins me in studio along with Nancy Karp. Nina Menendez, artistic director of the 12th Annual Bay Area Flamenco Festival 2017, shares festival details. Singers Kirk Doherty and Julie Adams talk about their roles in Opera San Jose's production of Silent Night. Actor Michael Doherty talks about his role in Hand to God at Berkeley Rep with a sock puppet on his right arm. And I'll also be talking briefly by phone with Nicole Piemont of Opera Parallel to talk about their production of Flight this weekend. Stay with us if you can. Nancy Karp and Dancers returns to ODC with the timely world premiere of Memory Place. Inspired by the current era of human mass migration, artistic director Nancy Karp has made a work in three parts. The first two movements, set to newly commissioned scores by Koi Dong and Robert Hanstein, respectively, and the third to the late Lou Harrison's almost 30-year-old grand duo for piano and violin that'll be performed by Sarah Cahill and Kate Stenberg. A sextet of dancers will be accompanied by three award-winning musicians, including the aforementioned Sarah and Kate, as well as cellist Gianna Abandolo. Memory Place runs this weekend with performances Friday and Saturday at 8, Sunday at 7, and information at odcdance.org, which we'll talk about additionally in just a moment. Since forming Nancy Karp and Dancers in 1980, Nancy has choreographed more than 70 works, appearing in venues around the globe. Over this time, the company has earned a reputation for striking interdisciplinary collaborations, commissioning numerous composers, visual artists, and designers in the creation of new dances. It's a pleasure to welcome Nancy back to our studios. Hi, Nancy.
Hi there.
She's joined by composer Koi Dong, who was born in China and is currently on faculty at Dartmouth College. Koi has earned accolades for her avant-garde compositions influenced by jazz, classical, and traditional Chinese music, using both acoustic and electronic instrumentation. Among her numerous commissions are works performed by the Central Ballet Group of China, Spain's National Tenerife Symphony Orchestra, Arditi Quartet, Ars Electronica, Del Sol Quartet, Volti, and many more. For Memory Place, Koi has written a duet for violin and cello. Welcome to you, Koi Dong.
Well, thank you.
Nancy, I seem to be reading so much into almost every work of performance art lately, given the Orwellian happenings in Washington, D.C. over the past month or so. But your presentation really does strike a chord, if you'll allow me that musical metaphor, though I'm sure the work was conceived well before our own domestic immigration crisis.
Yes, this work began actually 2 years ago. And there are many levels to this particular new project. And I think spending part of the year in Sicily, in southern Italy, where we have a home, and seeing it first, just very first up close of the mass migration of hundreds of thousands of people coming through this small island with the hope of going further to Europe to find a new place was one of the ideas that sparked this piece. But this was well over 2 years ago, and mm-hmm. here we are today where...
Well, last week I talked with Vietnamese musician Van An Vo about her work, which centers on the Vietnamese boat people. We have this whole Syrian crisis, and now it's just... I was talking with our host of Your Call this morning, Rose Aguilar. Why hasn't this world evolved? It seems to have devolved rather than evolved.
Well, I think we're in very dark times, and I hope that we will soon hit bottom and start rising again. One of the ideas of this piece is to try to create a work of beauty, which I think is very important right now, and this is one of the ideas behind the piece is to try to put the audience in an open new place.
How is this coming out? How is this subject coming out in the choreography? How are things moving on stage?
Well, my work since the beginning has been abstract, where we try to find the essence of particular movements of everyday life, of ideas that we all carry with us, the ideas of dislocation, reorientation, isolation, and how do we express that in movement. I work a lot with the space between the dancers, the space on the stage. I use a lot of this as metaphor for real life occurrences. For example, one idea at the very beginning of the concept of this piece was to work with the edges and corners of the stage. And these are often neglected by a lot of choreographers. I think choreographers tend to enjoy the center of the stage, which is the hot spot. And so we've tried to activate the corners and the edges in a way as a metaphor for people coming to a new place, feeling as if one is at the edge of a society and slowly finding one's way into a new society.
You mentioned that your work is primarily abstract, but is there also an element of improvisation involved, or is everything pretty well scripted out for the dancer?
Everything is absolutely set.
Okay.
I'm a formalist. And the dancers have this, of course, as most dance companies have this extra sense. There's a pulse that goes through the company, and everyone is aware on the edge of their skin of where everyone else is in the space.
So how, I'm curious, how is it documented? How do you make sure that they know what, is there a lab annotation, or is there some way that this is?
I have my own notation that I actually created way back in the 80s that I continue to use, which are diagrams as if you're looking from above at the spatial patterns mm-hmm. of the dancers, because that's also very important element. But we have video.
Oh, true enough. I was going to say, new technology must be very handy.
And in my studio, I have these steps up to a loft, and I videotape looking down, and I can capture everything so that we can repeat sections that are good and then get rid of the sections that are not so good as we're developing the piece.
Well, speaking of the visuals and what we'll be hearing, how did you first come across the music of Khoi Dong?
Several years ago, I was introduced to Khoi's music, and I asked her permission to use a piece of already commissioned music on a work we made 2 years ago, and she was generous and granted us permission. And then she was on the East Coast and couldn't come to the performance, and I showed her a video of the performance. And what was so gratifying to me was a comment. I was a little nervous to see. Well, I hope I did her music justice. And she commented to me how she appreciated how I allowed her music to breathe. I think both of us are interested in not animating the other discipline. Mm-hmm. And so about a little over a year ago, we began a discussion about our first collaboration together.
Mm-hmm. So how, chicken and egg kind of thing, did the music come first, or did you kind of show Khoi what you wanted expressed in dance by?
Well, I always choreograph in silence. I feel that that allows the dance to be strong on its own. Mm-hmm. And Khoi and I talked, had many discussions, and we came up with this concept of memory place. And it was actually Khoi who gave the work the title, because I was talking in circles a bit about my ideas and the different levels of the piece. And she said, oh, what you're talking about is memory and place.
I'm a good listener.
Well, let's hear you talk a little bit now. You've been a very good listener so far during this program. Let's hear a little
and
bit about your duet.
You can talk about how our working together evolved.
Right. We have this concept that actually all I know from our past conversation before writing the music is that we're going to write for 15 minutes of music, the length, and also the section. There are three sections. That's all we know. And we both want to approach it in a independent way, so I decided not to look at her video. I know that she's been sending me videos, but I refused to look at it. But because I've been so busy, and then there was only like 1 month before the deadline of submitting the score, so maybe I should look at it. So, well, I started looking at the video, and I realized that even though I know that her choreography is abstract, I recognize the pattern. It's a very human part of it that moves me. So I decided, okay, I'm going to watch your video many times. And then, as we said, we don't want to animate any
specific moves. Yeah.
But it turned out that it actually, the important points is all matched perfectly. On its own. So it's the best, I would say it's the best collaboration so far.
It all fell into place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, let's hear a little bit of the music from Coy Dong's work for violin and cello that will be heard this weekend as Nancy Karp and dancers present their show at ODC Theater. Then we'll talk more with Nancy and with Coy. Excerpt from Coy Dong's duet for violin and cello to be performed, as you heard there, by cellist Gianna Abbandolo and Kate Stenberg on violin. Beautiful writing, Coy.
Well, thank you.
Indeed. I understand that there's some visuals that are going to be involved for the whole presentation as well. Why don't you tell us about those, Nancy Karp?
Yes. We are working with a painting by Bay Area painter Tekla Hammond. It's been on a back wall or the end wall of my studio for several months, and a lot of the movement, actually the style of the movement, the dynamics of the movement, has been inspired by this painting, which has a lot of action and stillness, density and openness to the painting. And excuse me. And so we will be projecting details from this painting on the backdrop. They will slowly dissolve or wipe from one to another to create a sense of time, the duration from the moment we start the piece until it concludes.
Mm, interesting. We should also mention the other composer involved in these performances, Robert Hahnstein, who is co-founder and director of the Fast Forward Austin Music Festival. What is his contribution in terms of style of music for this?
Robert has given us, we've commissioned a piece for solo violin. Kate Stenberg will be playing with electronics. And the genesis of that was that Kate had originally commissioned him to write a short piece for violin. And through discussions with Kate, she suggested, well, Robert might be interested in extending it for dance. So we had conversations, and he lives in Boston, and this was another long-distance collaboration, and he would send samples. And what started out to be originally a 7-minute piece for Kate is around an 18, 19-minute piece for the dance company.
Oh, terrific. And the final section of Memory Place is set to 3 movements of Lou Harrison's Grand Duo from 1988, performed by Sarah Cahill and Kate Stenberg, in recognition of the centenary of his birth this year. I understand you were friends with Lou.
Many years ago, when I first moved to the Bay Area, he was a type of mentor to me. And as a young choreographer, which happens to many choreographers, I believe, there are often more people on the stage than in the audience. And Lou was one of the people who was always coming up from Santa Cruz Aptos up to the Bay Area.
Such a wonderful personality.
Yes.
And such a brilliant soul.
Yes.
Really was. We're hearing a bit of the grand duo performed in the background, which you'll hear Sarah Cahill and Kate Stenberg perform this Friday and Saturday at 8, Sunday at 7 p.m. I should also mention that this Sunday's performance is the reason why Sarah Cahill won't be hosting Revolutions Per Minute this Sunday evening. She's asked me to step in for her. So join me instead of Sarah Cahill on Sunday night from 8 to 10. And before that, though, catch Nancy Carpendancers at ODC Theater on 17th Street. Information at odcdance.org. Nancy Carp, Khoi Dong, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thank
it was
you.
A pleasure.
Taste of Lou Harrison's duet, which will be performed by Nancy Carpendancers this weekend at ODC Theater, odcdance.org. Good afternoon. David LaTulipe with you for Open Air. Still to come, you'll hear about this Silent Night opera by Kevin Putz being staged by Opera San Jose. A talk with Michael Dougherty of Hand to God being staged at Berkeley Rep. Riotous show is that. And I'll talk with Nicole Paimont about Opera Parallels production this weekend. Well, there's no shortage of opportunities to experience true flamenco artistry in the Bay Area lately. Last week, we were treated to a live studio performance of Noche Flamenca's interpretation of the Antigone story, currently at Z-Space. And today, I'm pleased to be joined by someone who has been responsible for bringing some of the finest talent from Spain and elsewhere to share their talents for the Bay Area Flamenco Festival, now in its 12th year, and recognized as one of the most vibrant flamenco festivals in the United States. Nina Menendez, a talented singer in her own right, is the founder and artistic director of Festival Flamenco Gitano USA and director of Bay Area Flamenco, which, in addition to the forthcoming concerts, offers year-round workshops and cultural exchanges. Nina, welcome back to Open Air in our temporary space here.
Thank you, David. It's wonderful to be here.
Your particular focus is on grassroots flamenco. What is the distinction?
Well, flamenco, the type of artist that we present, for them, flamenco is a way of life, of everyday life. It comes down through the family bloodlines, and it's part of the expression of the cultural identity and the oral history of the gypsy people of the south of Spain. So These are artists who learn flamenco in the family. They never had to go to a class or learn it at school, and yet they've achieved the status of world-class artists and are presented in the finest theaters all over the world, carrying this tradition that they bear as authentic grassroots artists.
And where are you coming across these talents?
Well, I maintain a steady communication and relationship with artists and artist families that I've gotten to know over the years due to my great love for flamenco and for particularly for the culture of gypsy flamenco in Spain. So, of course, I go there as often as possible and keep in touch as well when I'm not there.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get a brief overview of the festival, which runs from the 12th through the 25th.
Yes. Well, this Sunday we're kicking off the festival at La Peña Cultural Center. The show's already been sold out, so I won't speak a lot about it, but it is very exciting that opening night we'll be featuring a fine dancer from Huelva, El Choro Molina, accompanied by a group of artists from Jerez de la Frontera. Then the festival continues. First, we're going to be meeting the artists in New York City and presenting them on the 17th at Pace University Schimmel Center. These are Jose Maya's troupe. Jose Maya is one of the great dancers of his generation, along with Farruquito and several others that we've presented in previous editions of the festival. But Jose Maya will be coming to present his new piece, Latente, at the Herbs Theater on February 19th. And then on
that'll be a West Coast debut for Jose.
That's true. That's the West Coast debut of this incredible piece, Latente, latent in English, which really discovers he goes on a journey of self-discovery and is met by the ancestral voice represented by the incredible gypsy singer Juana La del Pipa, and finds his true self and his true roots in the course of a wonderful choreography that spans all various styles of flamenco and ends up in the most pure grassroots style.
And again, that's Sunday the 19th at 7 p.m. at the Herbst Theater for Jose Maya.
That's in San Francisco, in the Civic Center, right next door to the Opera House there, and the War Memorial. So the Herbst Theater on the 19th, Sunday the 19th. Mm-hmm. A few days later, we'll be presenting a concert of the singers that are coming with the troupe. The legendary Juana La del Pipa and Enrique El Extremeño will be performing at the Brava Theater in San Francisco on 24th Street. And then the festival wraps up on Saturday the 25th at La Peña Cultural Center once again with a group of amazing artists from Jerez de la Frontera, including Pepe del Morao, represents the dynasty of flamenco guitarists from Jerez de la Frontera. And that's going to be a very special performance on the 25th, Saturday the 25th at La Peña Cultural Center in Berkeley.
Well, let's hear a little bit of flamenco, since we're talking about it so much. You brought a couple of excerpts. What are we going to hear first?
Juana La del Pipa.
Ay, no me grite, no me llore, lo nuestro ya se acabó. Eran pétalos de flores. Vino el viento y lo tiró. Y así pasó nuestro amor. No me grites, no me llores. Lo nuestro ya se acabó. Callecita oscura, te vi de baja, como me estaba tu gente mirando. Ay, ay, gitana malina, madre, pa' atrás.
A touch of flamenco for your Thursday afternoon. That was actually Enrique El Extremeño, Hace Tiempo, from Chorrito Bajo, and a 2015 recording. Some beautiful, beautiful music that we're going to be treated to, Nina.
That's right. On the 19th of February, Sunday, at the Herbst Theater, we're so excited to present Latente, this piece by Jose Maya, really celebrating the beauty and strength of flamenco and some of the most authentic forms of flamenco dance. He'll be joined there by a full cast of artists that we're very proud to present, including guitarist Pino Losada and three amazing gypsy singers, one of whom you just heard on recording, Enrique El Extremeño, also Juana La Del Pipa, and Manuel Tañé from Jerez de la Frontera. These artists are really bringing an authentic representation of gypsy flamenco, and they really feel that although it's wonderful to innovate and bring in all kinds of influences from other dance forms, which they touch upon a bit at the beginning of the piece, that when you get down to it, there's not really a need for much more than the guitar, a good dancer, good lighting, and great singing. And it's the cante flamenco that brings Jose Maya back to his roots, and it's a real celebration of the ancestral spirit, which comes down through a really kind of a seance in this performance that takes place between the artists. The chemistry between them is just unbelievable when you see how they're improvising throughout the piece, and it's the back and forth between the artists that sparks one in the end. The other will spark the dancer to go to deeper levels and find the duende in the dance.
And there's a beautiful setting of the Herbst Theater for all of this, and the beautifully renovated Herbst, so catch that performance if you can. Of course, BayAreaFlamencoFestival.org for tickets and information. You can also register for workshops at the website. Nina, any roadblocks to this year's artists given the current travel policy turmoil in Washington, or do you fear some future roadblocks?
Well, absolutely. There was a bit of a nail-biting situation waiting for the visas to come through. They now have all their visas, and
great,
part of the group traveled today, and the rest will be traveling in a couple of days. So they're on the road. They'll be here. But the way things are right now in Washington, you know, we were just not sure whether we would get any response from the visa applications. And at the last minute, things came through. But we really have to keep aware and active and speaking out about all of these issues. And these artists are certainly aware of that, and they also bring their experience of having come from a nomadic people that experienced the gypsies really have been lifelong refugees in many ways.
Yeah, sure.
And they know what it feels like to be excluded, and they're very much supporters of inclusion and human rights and civil rights, and this because their culture is a celebration of their identity. It's also a cultural resistance. So we're very proud to present this group. And also, they'll be giving a talk while they're here. There's going to be a lecture demo taking place in Berkeley on Wednesday, the 22nd of February, at the Unitarian Church on Cedar Street in Berkeley. And there's information on our website about it. But they'll be talking a lot about how this culture goes beyond the stage. It's really mainly in the community. It's mainly a family tradition. And it's very interesting to hear them talk about it themselves, not just see them perform, but also get a chance to hear what they have to say and see some video clips and things like that of how this works. And mainly to be focusing around the morao guitar playing dynasty of Jerez de la Frontera, where Moraito and them come from.
Concert and workshop information at BayAreaFlamencoFestival.org. Nina, thank you so much for all the work you've done for this festival, and now in its 12th year, congratulations on that.
Thank you.
And smooth sailing down the road, we'll see.
We're very excited.
Next the aforementioned Juana La Del Pipa, who will be performing as part of the Herbst concert this next Sunday, the 19th. Again, information, BayAreaFlamencoFestival.org. Thanks, Nina. La calle nueva, vamos allá. Juana La Del Pipa, a part of the Herbst performance on the 19th, Bay Area Flamenco Festival.org. For more information, my thanks to Nina Menendez for keeping us up to speed on all things flamenco here on KLW and Open Air. Well, in this hypersensitive political landscape with nations on hair trigger alert, Opera San Jose is offering an olive branch with an opera that recalls an extraordinary moment, sadly not lasting, during World War I when, on a Christmas Eve in the trenches, arms were laid down when three Scottish, French, and German officers negotiated a Christmas Eve truce, and strains of Silent Night were heard floating softly over no man's land as one voice became many and enemies laid down their arms to celebrate a fleeting, precious night of peace and hope. This World West Coast premiere of Silent Night has music by Kevin Putz, who won a 2012 Pulitzer for his score, commissioned by the Minnesota Opera, with a libretto by Mark Campbell, who is also Mason Bates' collaborator for his forthcoming premiere at Santa Fe Opera of The Revolution of Steve Jobs. I talked with Opera San Jose's general director Larry Hancock back in September about the full Opera San Jose season, which opened with Donizetti's Lucia, and last April with Kirk Dougherty about his role in the Opera San Jose production of A Streetcar Named Desire. Kirk is in his third season as a company member of Opera San Jose, and this season was heard as Edgardo in the aforementioned production of Lucia, and the standout roles Alma Viva in Rossini's Barber of Seville and Cavaradossi in Tosca in recent seasons. This summer he'll roll the dice on the role of the Count for Opera's Las Vegas production of Rigoletto. A pleasure to welcome you back, Kirk.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
He's joined by Julie Adams, who makes her debut with Opera San Jose this season as Anna Sorensen in Silent Night. Among many other accolades, Julie is a winner of the 2014 Metropolitan Opera National Council auditions and recipient of a 2015 Sarah Tucker Study Grant. She's a second-year San Francisco Opera Adler Fellow and alumna of the Marilla Opera Program, where she recently performed the role of Blanche DuBois, coincidentally, in Previn's A Streetcar Named Desire, but here in San Francisco, not San Jose. She also sang the role of Rose in Weill's A Street Scene with Michael Morgan in the Oakland East Bay Symphony. Julie, welcome to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. Well, first I'd like to ask Julie about your role, Anna Sorensen. We're talking about the trenches of the Western Front here. Not
yes,
many women
yes.
in sight, I imagine, but
no.
Tell us the backstory about Anna and how she fits into the opera.
Anna Sorensen, so obviously with that name, she is of Danish descent. And her character is so, so beautiful in this opera to me. She is pretty much the pure definition to me of strength and innocence and beauty. She is Niklaus's Sprink's girlfriend, and they are both opera singers, and devises a plan as she realizes, obviously, with Sprink being away, how much she misses him, and just how she cannot survive without him. So she devises a plan to write to the Crown Prince and have a concert so that he can be pulled out of war temporarily, and it's just so she can see him. And she thinks, great, everything's going to be fine. But upon that concert, she finds him completely a changed man. He can't finish the song, and she has to encourage him that it's all okay. But she really realizes then he's definitely changed by war.
Wow.
And so when she realizes this and she sees this and he says, you know, I can't stay. I have to go back. I have to go back and be with my, you know, fellow soldiers help them celebrate Christmas. She's shocked, but she also, realizes what a beautiful thing that is. So she says, well, I'm going to go with you. And he's like, no, you're not. And I said, absolutely, I am. And she arranges that. She says she has her passports all ready to go, and they go. And it's that strength, it's that courage, and it's that determination that she has and that he has, and their love for one another is just so beautiful. So it's an honor to portray such an amazing character.
Mm. Well, the Christmas truce is a well-known historical event. Is there anything else in the opera that's historically accurate, or is this a convention of the storytelling? Kirk?
Well, there actually was an opera singer who did sing at this event.
Wow.
Historically.
Okay.
And I play the character Niklaus Sprink, what Julie's saying is totally for my character and for our German thread of this story, very true. Trying to find a very true depiction of what it would be like to be a person drafted to this and fighting this war and questioning the war, and my relationship with my lieutenant is very very difficult, and it leads to a bunch of actions which consummates making a very important decision at the end of the opera. I don't know if I should give that away, but basically the Christmas truce is a moment in which Anna goes with Sprink to the front lines and observes some of the carnage of the battle, but also she sees me go over the top of the trenches and sing for the men of all sides. And one of the more beautiful things in this opera, you get to see the sides, the thread of the story that is German, the thread of the story that is French, and the thread of the story that is the Scottish armies, how they interact, and surtitled, of course, but all the different languages, and the musical writing itself describes the national character of each side's music.
Hmm. Interesting. And how are you finding Kevin Putz's writing? He obviously incorporates Silent Night, which we'll hear shortly. But how is his writing compared to other contemporary composers you've worked with or sung?
Well, many composers write in a uniform style to show their voice, and I think what Kevin Putz does in this score really shows the voice of each character through a variety of styles. You can hear almost every style of music in this piece, from Middle Ages, Renaissance, Baroque music in a German style, French music in a Romantic style, and Scottish folk songs, one of which is newly composed for this particular piece. The timbre of instruments, bagpipes are used, harmonica plays, very unique orchestration, music to a battle scene. There is action on stage.
Even the Germans, too. The German, I find his German writing is somewhat significant of and resembles Strauss. And, you know, it's mm-hmm. it's very rhythmic, the Germans, the Germans' music, whereas the French is a little bit
more fluid.
A little bit more like Debussy. So it's very interesting.
Follows the stress of each language.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There are some opera excerpts that we sing in the beginning.
Okay.
There's an opera within the opera.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Nice.
And to the libretto, I think what's unique about the piece is the character of Niklaus and Anna. They sing about war, but in their opera, in a sort of a 18th century version of their opera, it doesn't have the same kind of grit, realism that the characters in the opera suddenly experience. And mm-hmm. so when they do have the concert for the Crown Prince, and she says, "Now you're back, you've come back to me from the war, we can stay together."
It's a whole different meaning.
Yeah, there's an irony to that because that's what they sang about in their opera.
Mm.
But now he knows that he has a duty to the people he's been fighting with, and he has to go back to them.
Silent Night will be conducted by Joseph Marchesio at Opera San Jose through February 26th. Kirk playing Nicholas Sprink, and your companion, Julie Adams, performing the role of Anna Sorensen. Kirk, you'll be Rodolfo in the upcoming production of La Boheme. Looking forward to that. Julie, what's coming up for you?
Well, I will be also, I'm actually going to be performing in Boheme as well. I'll be performing it with three performances with Opera San Jose, and then I will be performing the role of Mimi in two performances with San Francisco Opera.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Fantastic. I wish both of you well in this production and beyond. Let's hear a little bit of music of Kevin Putz from Silent Night. The libretto, other than from Silent Night, the actual hymn is by Campbell, Mr. Campbell, missing the...
Mark Campbell.
Mark Campbell. Music of Kevin Putz with Mark Campbell. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Music of Kevin Putz from Silent Night. Time is fleeting in this hour of open air. Still much to come. Robert Askin's play, Hand to God, opens at Berkeley Rep tomorrow evening, running through March 19th. It's a dark but wacky look at the inner drivings and clash of the id, ego, and superego via a church teen puppet group in Cypress, Texas. The inner workings of this puppet show and the action of the play, not something you'd want to take the kiddies to, by the way. It's directed by David Ivers, who brought his wonderful direction to 2015's Berkeley Rep production of One Man, Two Governors, and stars Michael Dougherty as the teen Jason, seemingly possessed by the sock puppet on his arm, Tyrone. Michael makes his Berkeley Rep debut in this role and has been seen in a number of regional theater productions around the country. I caught up with him after Tuesday afternoon's tech rehearsal in Berkeley. Listener's note, I also talk with the more profane sock puppet, Tyrone, whose language has been edited for broadcast on public radio. Welcome to Open Air.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, first of all, for taking the time right after rehearsal to sit down with me, Michael, or at least after an all-important light and tech rehearsal. Lots of trap doors and moving walls to watch out for. Tiring in its own way, but a necessary thing.
Indeed it is. I haven't worked with too much automation before, so it's actually one of the cooler parts of this job, getting to ride things onto the stage. It's really cool.
And the first time that you're working with puppets, I understand.
Indeed. I don't have any experience. I've always been curious about it. Like, I was way into Avenue Q when that was on Broadway and stuff. But yeah, first time puppet in hand, and it's been an experience.
So to get our audience up to speed, your character, Jason, is part of this church puppet theater group in Texas, led by your mom, Marjorie, that is supposed to be enacting Bible stories, but is also a sort of therapy group.
It is, yeah. So just before, about 6 months before the start of our play, Jason's father has passed away because of a heart attack. And Marge, my mom, starts this thing as a way to sort of help her distract herself, and Jason really throws himself into it to sort of like give him something to do, and he becomes quite good at it. And little do we know before the events of the play, he's started to develop a little bit of a relationship with this puppet that's maybe beyond his own comprehension. That's something a little outside of himself.
Well, speaking of the puppet in your, let's see, right hand, I guess it is, mm-hmm. Your mom in the play, Marjorie, has been going through a lot. Now, how would you describe your family dynamic? Or maybe we should ask Tyrone, who is your alter ego, the family dynamic at home.
Oh, sure, yeah. It's a little fucked up right now, you know. Marge isn't taking it too well, and I don't think since Dad's been out of the picture that their communication has been really on point, and it becomes pretty clear pretty early on what's happening here. And next thing you know, shit hits the fan, and communication is down, and it's really, really sad. It's really fucked up. And they gotta have a come-to-God moment, if you will. And I aid along the way in that. I say the things that others don't want to say.
Okay, well, maybe we'll leave Tyrone out of the rest of the conversation. Thanks very much, Tyrone.
He's very domineering.
Well, it's interesting that sock puppets have had that fundamental connection to people, allowing them to act out. Did you ever indulge in sock puppets as a kid? Although I imagine you're of the age where you probably created one on an iPad and then printed it on a 3D printer.
Not quite. I mean, I remember I did a project on Jim Henson when I was in third grade, and I made a sock puppet from scratch, a la Kermit the Frog, and I got really into it for that year, but. Not much other than being obsessed with the Muppets, you know? And I was, like, of the Muppet Christmas Carol, Muppet Treasure Island generation, the Brian Henson stuff. But, I was always obsessed. So it's so cool to be doing... Because unlike the sock puppets from the original Broadway production, these are a lot closer to Henson Studios Muppets, created by Amanda Villalobos, our fantastic puppet designer and teacher for our process.
Well, I also had no idea the widespread history of puppet use, not only apparently in fundamental churches from Texas and beyond for telling stories to children, but back hundreds of years ago to even before marionettes, with the name Marion referring to the Virgin Mary.
I did not know that. Yeah, I know it's like hundreds of years old, the tradition of puppetry. It's really something. I mean, it makes sense that it's such a part of storytelling. And actually, the more surprising thing to me is that it's still so pervasive now in the American theater. There's so much puppetry happening right now in many different ways, and it's really cool how they're trying to make it accessible again.
Well, talking back again about childhood, I distinctly remember my own preteen years in Connecticut. I used to make sock puppets and sew the buttons on, and then play records and charge my siblings 25 cents to get into the show, but 35 cents to get out.
There you go. Yeah. I mean, I find a good exercise that I always do with the puppets is just a little lip sync challenge, play a song and have him rock out along with it.
Well, fair to say that although it seems like Tyrone is out of control and possessing you, that his very rawness and unfilteredness, if you will, is expressing what you, the character Jason, are really feeling, free of societal norms and filters.
I think that's a really good point. I recently read an interview with Robert Askins, the playwright, and he expressed how this story is very close to his heart, and he grew up in a church group, and around the time he was 16, that he lost his father, and his mom started this thing, and there was things that he couldn't express that he allows Tyrone to express in the story that sort of makes it his id, you know, his things that a 16-year-old maybe couldn't articulate. And whether it is that strictly or whether it is the devil actually in this boy's hand, I think is up for interpretation. I think the point is that it's something that this boy is incapable of saying, but he's in turmoil and he's lost. He needs this, you know.
Well, part of the turmoil that's in the play, we mentioned that your mom is Marjorie. She's been going through a lot. Another puppet troupe member, Timothy, is involved in also expressing some rather raw, shall we say, unfiltered feelings, and even of a sexual nature. Does Jason's feelings about that only come out through Tyrone?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it's all about behavior, you know what I mean? So there's a lot that Jason is feeling that he doesn't say. And I think when he steps up to someone, it's in a very different way than Tyrone would do it. Tyrone is much more the guy who says what's on his mind. Jason's too polite. He's too kind a person to actually say how he feels, to make someone uncomfortable, even if it's tearing him up inside.
Well, let's add the other dynamic of the relationships, the purer one, if you can call it that, the teen angst attraction of Jason and Jessica, who's also attracted to Timothy in its own weird way. Mm-hmm. But it's Tyrone who's able to say things to Jessica that Jason can't.
Yeah, it's funny. Tyrone is both the bridge to Jessica and the one who sets the bridge ablaze. You know, it's like Jason would be maybe a little too shy in retiring to make the connection that he wants to make. The puppet is the perfect excuse to show her something cool, but then also the thing that always steps over the line and gets Jason into trouble.
And to top things off in the storyline, Pastor Greg is after your mom as well.
That's right. That's right. And that's, you know, it's like every outside force aside from Jason and Marjorie, this little family unit is infiltrating the family in various ways and almost across the board, like tugging at heartstrings and messing with us psychologically.
Well, this right now is the most produced play in the United States. Have you yourself seen any of the other productions?
I've not. I've seen some YouTube clips of like trailers for the other ones, but I've yet to see it on stage, which I think is for the best, because then we got to approach it anew and make discoveries ourselves. And it makes perfect sense why it's being produced so much, because it is a perfectly structured play. It's so well set up for these payoffs that happen throughout and for these reveals. And it's funny as heck and really dark and surprisingly moving. You know, it's at the end of the day, it's a story about a mom and her son who need to reconnect and the societal constructs we put up that get in the way of communication and actually connecting with someone.
Well, you mentioned Avenue Q. Is perhaps the next step for you after Hand to God, that show, or Lion King, or War Horse, now that you've gotten the puppet thing down?
Yeah, well, when Amanda Villalobos went away, she's like, you're a puppeteer now. She's like, you're doing it. I'm like, I am? So I'll be really curious to see how it comes into my life in the future. But it's so much fun, and at a certain point, very intuitive. So I'd be curious. I mean, this is just the simple hand and arm bar puppet. So there's plenty of other kinds of puppetry styles that I haven't even begun to explore.
Where is home base for you? Are you basically the vagabond actor? I see all over the map for you in your resume.
Yeah, for a while I was pretty nomadic, but I cut my teeth in Philly, and that is where I currently reside with my girlfriend in South Philadelphia. And I've been spending most of the time the past few years outside of it, but that's where I live, and I try to do a show there a year. But I've got an agent up in New York, and I'm kind of all over the place.
Well, I'm sure the Bay Area is going to enjoy this run from the New York Times on the occasion of its first and second off-Broadway runs. Quote, a foul-mouthed, fun-packed play about the urges that drive good men and women and boys to dirty deeds. Almost as disturbing as it is uproarious. A good quote, I think. Mm-hmm. Hand to God is at Berkeley Rep through March 19th, opening Saturday. BerkeleyRep.org. Honest to God, it's a hoot. The very talented Michael Dougherty stars as Jason and Tyrone. You'll also be treated to a virtuosic one man and his puppet rendition of Abbott and Costello's Who's on First routine as well, from what I see in the script. Thanks again for your time today. Hey, maybe any last words from Tyrone?
Yeah, come check this shit out. We're gonna burn this place to the ground. It's real fucked up. You'll laugh, you'll cry, you'll piss yourself laughing.
Thanks very much, Jason and Tyrone. Michael, cheers.
Really appreciate it. We really do. Thank you very much.
Well, that on-site talk went all too quick. As a less profane puppet might say, time's sure fun when you're having flies. Hand to God also features David Kelly as Pastor Greg, Michael McIntyre as Timothy, Laura O'Day as Marjorie, and Carolina Sanchez as Jessica. Again, BerkeleyRep.org for tickets. More information on the show, as well as some fun video teasers. By the way, if you haven't recycled it yet, last Sunday's Pink Pages in the San Francisco Chronicle has an extensive story on the history of puppets and an interview with Michael Dougherty and director David Ivers by freelance writer Claudia Bauer. Well worth the read. Well, yet another timely offering this weekend comes from the outstanding group Opera Parallèle, under the direction of Nicole Paimon, who joins me by telephone. The work is called Flight, with music by Jonathan Dove and a libretto by Angela De Angelis, and is a dramatization of the true story of the forced residence from 1988 to 2006 of Iranian refugee Mehran Karimi Nasseri at Charles de Gaulle Airport. The story most notably was interpreted by director Steven Spielberg for his 2004 film, The Terminal. Jonathan Dove's score dates from 1998. Nicole Paimon, welcome once again to Open Air, and I apologize in advance for our all-too-brief time together this time around.
No problem. I'm glad to be there.
Well, yet again, the stars align in the bizarre coincidence of the performing arts world presenting something that makes us think of the current happenings in Washington. But again, this was planned, and the events happened well before any of the current headlines.
Yes, of course. I mean, we chose this piece 2 years ago almost. So, and you know, it was written for the 1990s, but it shows actually that, you know, really contemporary art has relevance for a long time when it's a worthwhile piece. I mean, I think that all masterworks, in many ways, you can find relevance somehow. But this one definitely points at something that is very timely right now.
This is taking a lighter look at a subject that may become even more familiar given recent policy proposals from Washington. How is Jonathan Dove and the librettist serving up the humorous aspect of the story?
Well, you know, I think that beyond all of the story of the refugee and that, the story is really about the human condition and about how people, when put in a situation, are survivors. And the refugee, one of the great thing about the opera is that at the beginning of the opera, the refugee is, they're all stuck in the airport, all these various people that are coming from various places in their lives. And the refugee asks for help from them, and they all have their comical side. Some come from, you know, wanting to travel to reignite their love affair. Others are very different couples, and they are all there with the refugee. And when the refugee needs help, they don't give it to him at the beginning. And with time, all being stuck in the airport and realizing that nature and storms are stronger and more powerful than they all are, they get closer. And by the end, when the refugee asks for help, they have become friends and they want to help him. So you see the growth in terms of how through the lens of someone stuck in an airport and then other people sharing that situation, all of a sudden human condition is strong, and it's a very powerful message. And so there are, you know, the opera has moments of great, where you will laugh. It is very, very, very funny and done with great art. It's not easy to write comic opera. But then you will also cry. And, you know, the director keeps saying in the rehearsal, comedy is a serious affair. And it's true. And so at times, you will see, especially at the end of the opera, there's a great moment where the refugee explains and sings a beautiful aria that explains why he is stuck without papers in the airport. And you will definitely be moved to tears during that aria. So there's the span of emotion during the opera is very wide and very moving and touching.
Well, the stars do indeed align, as you've got a stellar cast of singers lined up for this production, including baritone Hadley Adams, who was heard in Opera Parallèle's production of Les Mamelles de Tiresias of Poulenc, Eugene Brancoviano, who you've worked with on a number of productions, Catherine Cook, likewise, including a memorable Dead Man Walking, Philip Skinner, who was Kurtz in Heart of Darkness from Opera Parallèle, and Tai One as the refugee and subject of the opera.
And we also have a wonderful Adler, Nadine Sierra. And so, you know, out of the 10 member singers, we have 7 that are either from the Merrill or the Adler Fellows. So we're very proud that we have also a wonderful connection with the San Francisco Opera in that way.
Well, Nicole, thanks so much for taking a little bit of time. Nicole, conducting and directing Opera Parallèle's production of Flight. It's at the Yerba Buena Center, ybca.org, tomorrow and Saturday at 8, Sunday at 2. Congratulations also, Nicole, on being appointed principal guest conductor of the Dallas Opera.
Oh, thank you very much. And I hope that many of you come and see this wonderful opera this weekend.
We look forward to it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that's Open Air for this week. A reminder that our shows are archived at www.kalw.org. If you've got a show suggestion, send me an email, david@kalw.org. My thanks to Neil Swinkles for producing the show.